From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. 5 years ago today, two hijacked airliners crashed into the World Trade Center, a third into the Pentagon, and a fourth plane crashed in a Pennsylvania field before reaching its target. Over the last 5 years, we've heard countless stories of survival and loss, joy and tragedy. But one story has only recently come to light. It's the story of former Marine Jason Thomas. Thomas, with the help of fellow ex-Marine David Kearns, rescued two Port Authority officers buried in the rubble at the World Trade Center. But he never discussed his experience on the Ground Zero pile, and the identity of the Good Samaritan Marine became a mystery, until recently, when he finally stepped forward to tell his story. Here's Jason Thomas in his own words.
That morning was like no other morning. I remember it just running out to my car, grabbing my military uniform, which was in the trunk of my car, in a sea bag. I see three unmarked cars just fly by me, and they were just heading in the direction of Ground Zero. So I said, hey, let me attach myself to this convoy, because they're going in my direction. Less than a mile in, that's when I see the second tower collapse. And I remember getting out. I look, you know, turn around, and I see the cloud of ash heading right towards me. And it was coming really fast. So I remember just taking my head and sticking it down in my blouse and kneeling down, you know, beside my car, and it just engulfed my position. It felt like sandpaper, like the grit. It felt hot. It felt, you know, disturbing. It felt evil. I just said to myself, hey, I cannot stay here. I'm just getting up and just running in the direction of Ground Zero. And the streets are full of people, And everyone's just trying to get away. And I can hear explosions coming from one of the buildings, and it's loud explosions. It felt like bombs going off. And the fire trucks and an ambulance was completely covered in debris, and they're both on fire. Probably like 50 yards up that street, I see a figure in the middle of the road, and I'm yelling out to him, sir, are you okay? I didn't get any response, and I was looking for some signs of life. And I check his neck. I get nothing. I check his wrist, and nothing. And I look up at the gentleman's head, and I see this huge dent on his forehead. He had a huge dent. But amongst all of the rubble and chaos, you know, he did appear to be at peace. You know, he didn't have any signs of pain. He just, you know, eyes were closed, and he was an older male, white hair. And I remember just, you know, kneeling over top of him and saying a prayer, and I remember putting the cross on his forehead, and, you know, I had a blue third-degree blanket. But it just fell apart the more I would try to work with it, you know, the more it would fall apart. I put it around the gentleman and tried to tuck it under him, and my hands are going completely through the blanket. Some rescuers came over, and I remember just pushing on from there. I remember getting across the street from Section 21 right to the pile and turning around thinking that, okay, I'll have a 10, 15 guys will be following. And just like I said, it didn't work that way. It was just myself and Staff Sergeant Carnes. I knew that he was devoted to starting a search and rescue as well as myself. And the first step into the rubble, it was like, okay, let's see if we can even do this. You know, is this going to collapse? And I remember just starting to crawl across the twisted metal and hearing the sounds of, it was just the most deep sound of metal just grinding up against itself. And, you know, you hear concrete just falling apart, or, you know, just the ground was still being settled, or the pile of rubble was still settling. And I remember getting about a halfway across, you know, the pile of rubble, and I run into a huge void, and it's about 30 feet deep with black smoke pouring out of it, and you can see fire at the very bottom. But as I turn around to go to skirt this one void, I turn around and I see a firefighter, and he's standing on the very edge of the pile of rubble, and he's yelling at us, telling us to come back. And I said in a joking way, but I meant every word of it, we're Marines, we don't go backwards, we go forward. I remember him saying to me, good, don't come back, because if you do, you may get washed away. He said, because we're spraying off the building to the left and right. And I said, we have no intent on coming back. I made my way towards Staff Sergeant Carnes, and he jumped down onto this one beam that was about 3 feet wide, about 10 to 15 feet long. And I jumped down, you know, right after him. And I see this hole off to my left, and it's black smoke coming out. I remember yelling, not just Marines, is there anyone down there? And I got a voice. One of the officers got pretty emotional and didn't want us to leave. I think that he thought that we said we're going to get help. I'm telling him, hey, buddy, we're not leaving you. We're here to help. We're here to get you out. I remember Staff Sergeant Carnes saying something to him and immediately jumped down in the hole, and I followed. I jumped right behind him and lost my footing and tumbled down inside the hole. I remember landing on my back, and I see this bright piece of metal. It's about the size of my hand, and it's just bright red. I mean, it just hit me then that, wow, 11 or 12 hours later, I still have metal at just that size, red hot. I remember looking up and looking behind me, and I see this one beam that's going across, is coming up out of the hole, and resting on that beam was a ton of concrete. And I'm saying to myself, also, if this collapses, we're done. But I'm making my way to my hands and knees and yelling out for Staff Sergeant Carnes, and he answered back, and I made my way to him, and I'm feeling around because this hole is completely black. I'm just, as I'm feeling around, I remember just cutting my hand on something, or I won't say cutting my hand, but reopening a cut that I had on my hand. So this whole time that we're digging, we're talking to these guys, and Will Himino is getting, becoming frustrated because we have not physically located them. I mean, we can hear him and we can talk to him. He was close, like right beneath us, close, but did not see him. But I had my flashlight, and I remember seeing his hand wiggle, and he was like a level beneath us, but he had stretched out, reached out, and, I could see his fingers, just his fingers moving. He was completely covered in ash. I remember Officer Will Himino telling me that he had a child that was on the way. His wife was pregnant. I remember telling him that I just had a newborn baby, and sharing with him that I had, four kids. And my whole thing was trying to take their mind off of, or his mind off of, what he was going through at the time. Because with him being trapped for 11 or 12 hours, being in excruciating pain, I felt that I should talk to him and share intimate details with him about just my lifestyle, and that could take his mind off of what he's going through. Great. He threw a couple of jokes out there, so I felt that, this is good. He's, been trapped for this amount of time, but he still has a sense of humor. I remember coming out up out of the hole, and Staff Sergeant Carnes came out, and I remember asking him, hey, do you got a cell phone, and I said, because I don't have one on me. That area had started to get really bad. I had to fire off to the right, and there was smoke just coming from everywhere. That's like the only time that I felt that, hey, we may die down here trying to get these guys out. But at any time, I knew that I could walk away and just leave. But I had promised these guys that, I'm going to see them out. Because we're calling out and yelling out at this time for help. But there was no one on that pile of rubble. No one. About 20 minutes later, 15, 20 minutes later, I see a string of rescuers. They all had lights attached, appeared to have lights attached to them. And at about 3 o'clock, we get the first officer out, Will Himino. And I remember pushing him out. He was on a stretcher, and I'm patting him on his chest and stomach, and just pretty much alerting him, telling him, hey, you're out, or you okay, and that sort of thing. And I see them passing them down this gauntlet, you know, which was just amazing to see. And everyone is clapping and very emotional at that stage. But I didn't feel, I wasn't excited at all, you know, physically and mentally. I was just beat, could not go any further. I felt bad that I had to come out, that I had to drag myself away or out of that hole, because I had promised to see both of the officers out. I made my way back to my car and drove back to Long Island. I get to Long Island and get to my house. And, you know, I was going to go just into my house, but I felt my wife would be pretty pissed off if I tracked all the ash in, so I made my way to my backyard and got my hose and sprayed myself off and made my way in the house. I'm taking a shower and then just going to sleep. When I woke up about 3 hours later, I don't know if it was my mind playing tricks on me, which I, you know, it had to be, nightmare, but I remember hearing voices. They were saying pretty much there was more people down that hole and I can hear people crying out. And about three hours later, I remember getting right back up and telling my wife, "Hey, I'm going back to ground zero."
Thomas returned to the World Trade Center site every day for 2.5 weeks. He hasn't spoken with David Karn since the night they spent in the rubble. Today, Thomas, his wife, and 5 children live in Ohio. You can hear an extended version of this audio essay at our website at npr.org.